I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root artist feature. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Masoud Olufani. Masoud, how you doing?
I'm good, brother. What's happening, man?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you in today. I'm very curious about how you process history, because our listeners may not know that you also act.
Yeah, I do.
And you have portrayed famous African-Americans in history, Malcolm X, Frederick Douglass, but also within your visual art, you have a sense of acknowledging history.
Yeah.
So I wonder how you approach either your research or just how you contextualize history.
Yeah. I think really in the context, you know, I approach it from two different disciplines, obviously, as an actor and then also as a visual artist. I think in regards, there's slightly two different processes for me. When it's acting, obviously, it's script related, and I'm really vibing off of the written text of a playwright. So what I do is kind of through the filter of their process and what they've created. Whereas with the visual work, I have a much more wide open space to kind of create and play with. So in the visual work, I think I'm much more conceptual in how I deal with history. I play with the kinds of the fluidity of history, how memory sometimes is a tricky business to kind of anchor things down, because in the space of time and conflicting narratives, where's the truth? What does it really lie? And I'm interested in those spaces, those spaces between the reality of thing, the moment that a thing happens, and then the space, the memory of a thing, and how the memory of the thing conforms to the actual event, and then also how it maybe conflicts with the actual event or expands the actual event. So I hope that answers your question, but that's what I'm thinking.
Well, how has our evolution into this digital age maybe changed that for you? Because we are in a moment in time where we capture a lot of things, at least visually, as well as audio wise, as this podcast can be a part of that. Mm-hmm. So given how much we capture now, how has this digital moment that we currently rest in changed that for you?
You know, I mean, I it's interesting because digital media, I mean, everybody has a camera. If you got a phone, you got a camera. So the exactness of an event, the physical actions, the words that are spoken are recorded, you know, for perpetuity with a digital device. But there's still gaps because there's always the moments before the thing happened, and there's also the moments after the thing happened when the camera's either turned off or somebody's gone on to something else. So there are still spaces in that context as well. And I think we have to allow that, for me anyway, when I think about digital media and the process of art making, I think on the one hand about the exactness of the media, but then I also think about some really interesting things taking place in the before and the after. And that's the big question. What's the context? What occurred the moment before the event happened, and what occurred the moments after, the stuff that's not recorded, and how does that inform the actual event that was recorded? So I think that's an interesting space to think about, that kind of playing with the notion, the idea that on the one hand, digital media is an exacting resource, the truth, if you will, but also understanding that it's a fallible medium if you take out of that equation the context, what happened before and what happened after. And I think those are interesting spaces to think about and work in.
Well, given your work, your visual work, and one of your pieces that from a contextual standpoint makes you ask some of those questions is Children of the Windy City.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's Children of Windy City, it's no big mystery if you think about it, what it's about. Windy City, of course, is a moniker for the city of Chicago. And Children of the Windy City, so it indicates what I was thinking about. What inspired me was the ongoing violent deaths of black and brown youth in the city of Chicago. which are not exclusively black and brown, but predominantly black and brown, or disproportionately black and brown. And I was interested in the weight of that loss, because the numbers are staggering, really. And we think about human potential, and human potential as being our most precious resource. What does that say about wasted potential, wasted resources of possibly future discoveries, knowledge? So I was very much moved by that and inspired by that. So I didn't want to do the idea for the piece was about treating each one of these kids who got murdered as an individual. So what and memorializing them in a way, but what I decided to do was basically do many different portraits of these kids' faces in Conti crayon and charcoal on just wood panels. And then I created some shelving units that that carry the portraits. And at the heart of this sea of portraits is a box, a plexiglass box, with a small handgun resting on an ornate pillow, that I stitched. And there was something about having that single violent object, that object that has potential for violence and being a symbol of death, and then the multitude of faces, of lives that are connected, surrounding an instrument like that. So for me, the work, it's ongoing because every day there are more kids being murdered in Chicago. So I really never run out of, unfortunately, I wish I did, but I never really run out of subjects to draw. So, I view it as being continuously in a process of development. And it's also a drawing exercise to be able to continue to exercise my hand, but also, as I'm doing that, contribute to something that I think has deep meaning and can say something about an illness that afflicts our contemporary society.
Well, let's talk about you and your past and how you got to Atlanta. So you're from New Jersey.
Yeah. And the high school in New Jersey.
High school
in, Newark.
In New Jersey.
Yeah.
And you went to Morehouse College.
I did, yeah.
So let's talk about maybe your beginnings in art and maybe your path up to now. So
sure.
Take us back to Newark, and what was that like for you growing up there?
Yeah, Newark was a great place. Contrary to a lot of popular beliefs, I had a great time in Newark. I moved around a lot as a high school student. I went to four different high schools, three different arts high schools. Started off at the arts high school in New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts, because I lived down there for about 2 years. And then I went to the Dallas Arts High School, which was a great experience. And then I finally wound up in Newark. The reason for that is because my parents divorced, so I was spending time with my father and time with my mom. So, Newark, I remember I was going to go to LaGuardia in New York City, but they have very strict districting policies. So I was living in Far Rockaway at the time in Queens at my grandmother's place, and my mother was trying to get me an arts high school. Well, she said, well, Newark will take you because they're not as strict on those policies, so they'll give us some leeway. So I literally, for the first probably 6 months of my junior year of high school, I would get up at 5 a.m, hop the train. We'll take the bus to the train in Far Rockaway, Queens, and to get to school to be there by 7:30. So, it was an interesting place because Newark is it's got this really rich history. The riots, the race riots that took place there back in the 60s. When I was a high school student there, you still had the gutted shells of the projects where many of the riots took place. So you would pass by these kind of like ghostly towers, and you just think about what it must have been like in the 60s when the riots took place there. And it's a city that's in a perpetual state of evolution or reinvention. or renaissance, as they say in Newark. Brick City is what they call it. But I found there in the art department there a lot of support. It was easy access to New York City, so I spent a lot of my time in Greenwich Village, going to the different museums in the city of New York. I had a good time, man. Grew a lot there. And from there, I started off at Parsons School of Design in New York City and transferred to Morehouse, actually. So I finished up my education at Morehouse. So, yeah.
And what was the driving decision to make that transfer?
For me, I was – well, Newark was Arts High School in Newark is predominantly African-American and Latino. So you may have what? I think it's probably 60% African-American, maybe 40% Latino. Going to Parsons when I went to school there was a real culture shock for me. It was difficult for me to make that transition. I was surrounded by kids whose parents would basically write them a check for tuition. I was raised primarily by my mom in a single parent home. So school financially was an incredible stretch for us. And I just found myself feeling a bit alienated from the process and a bit overwhelmed in a way. And I wanted to be in a place, I thought, for me, where my phenotype wasn't an issue, where I couldn't point to it being a cause for difficulty or, it just wouldn't be an issue. I could focus on just going to school. So Morehouse provided that opportunity for me. So, yeah.
And one thing about you that I've learned is that at least what I get from you is that education is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And so as your career has grown mm-hmm. and you've done other things, as mm-hmm. I mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
you also act and mm-hmm. you have your art career as well.
Mm-hmm.
You recently graduated from SCAD.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
With your MFA. So mm-hmm. at what point in your career did you decide that an MFA was the next step for you, at least from an educational standpoint?
Yeah. Well, SCAD was my second stab at grad school. I started out at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, in Richmond, Virginia. But I hated Richmond. Richmond was a real culture shock. They were going through some – I was going to school there at the time when they were trying to decide if they were going to have their first black statue on Monument Avenue, which was full of Civil War veterans for the Confederacy. And that black person was Arthur Ashe. Eventually, they did put a statue there. So I left Richmond and wasn't sure about my direction, didn't know what I was going to do, but came back to Atlanta and slowly started making art again. Finally got a studio out in Marietta. And lo and behold, not even thinking about grad school, to be quite honest with you, not sure if I wanted to go back to grad school. I happened to be in my studio working one day, and the owner of the facility said, look, there's some people coming over from SCAD. And they wanted me to recommend a few studios to take a look at. I told them you'd be one of them, so just be here tomorrow at whatever time. I think it's like 1:00. Be honest with you, I almost didn't go the next day. But a friend of mine said, no, go, just go. You know what's going to, just go. So I show up, and it's a group of students, and a woman in the background who didn't know who she was, and I do my little artist talk about my work. So the woman in the background turned out to be the chair of the Department of Sculpture at SCAD. They really liked my work. She liked my work. And she said, look, we'd like to get you over at SCAD. I said, yeah. I said, I've seen y'all's tuition breaks, y'all. It's a little hefty. So we talked, consulted. She's a very sweet lady by the name of Susan Krause. And we talked, and over the next few weeks, she said, well, this is what we'll do. We'll give you a half scholarship, rest of tuition you have to come up with. I said, I can't even afford a half scholarship. And I was really fortunate because Susan really went to battle for me and really believed in my talent, which is something I think I needed at the moment. I really needed somebody to affirm that. And she affirmed my talent, and which was critical at that point in my development. And lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, she said, I want you to come to the sculpture department because I want to talk to you. So I go down there and she said, look, this is what we're going to do. We will cover your tuition and we will buy your work as the way of paying for your tuition. So SCAD, for better or for worse, has a ton of my work in their permanent collection. And some of it's in Lacoste, their facility in Lacoste, France, and Savannah. And I think some of it's in Hong Kong, but that's how it worked out. So, I mean, I was very fortunate that I didn't have to incur any debt in grad school from SCAD, which I hear is really unusual because most people tell me most people tell me they have a hefty debt bill once they finish SCAD. So
very fortunate.
Yeah.
Very rare.
Yes.
And your work is very widely scattered around the world.
Yes.
So
it's bizarre, isn't it?
All pluses for you.
Yeah.
What I am interested in, mm-hmm. as it relates to your work, and given maybe just how you have moved through life, mm-hmm. you know, whether it was at Parsons, at VCU, mm-hmm. at Morehouse, living in New York or Newark, that area, mm-hmm. what kind of racial dialogue are you trying to have with your work?
It's an interesting question. I think, first of all, I think Jeffrey Holder was right when he says that America has been essentially cowards when it comes to the issue of race. I think we have a very difficult time speaking about subjects that reveal our flaws as a country. And I think also this country has practiced selective memory when it comes to our past. So the things that are shameful or difficult for us to talk about, we have a tendency to either want to negate or avoid in their entirety, or in some way diminish the importance of the repercussions of those events. For me and my work, I really look at my work as being about hopefully forcing a conversation to the fore, engaging the public in a way where it – I mean, I think essentially what I'm interested in doing, I think you have to bring a certain amount of courage when you look at some of the stuff that I make. And I think you have to be willing to engage around those difficult topics. From an aesthetic point of view, from a sociological point of view, from a historical point of view, issues of race, social stratification, those types of things. And look at those flaws, those crevices, those cracks in our democracy. And first of all, what did it mean and what does it mean in our contemporary frame of reference? And I think that's as important as the history of it. How is who we are now tied to what happened then? What does it mean for people of African descent? What does it mean for people of European descent? And how has the manner in which we live economically, the communities that we live in, the stresses that we've been exposed to, how are those things tied to that history? And I think when you look at it in that sense, when we have the courage to look at things that way, we stop pointing fingers at people and realize that behavior and where people wind up quite often is very much tied to what happened before. And I don't think there's any other way you can look at that in regards to people of African descent and all of the painful history that we've endured at the hands of this country and how we're disproportionately represented in the roles in poverty and other forms of various forms of addiction, and not feel deeply troubled by that, irregardless of your cultural background, because we're all a part of one human family. So in that sense, if one member of my family is sick, we're all sick.
Going back to that word coward or cowardice, mm-hmm. as it relates to our inability or unwillingness to confront this state, mm-hmm. and where that came from, does that cowardice cut both ways, mm-hmm. with people of European descent as well as those of African descent as it relates to that dialogue?
Yeah.
And how, I guess?
Well, the interesting thing about pathology, it expresses itself quite oftentimes across lines. I think that the pathology of race, of racism, the sickness that it is, it manifests. It's like a cancer. It metastasizes in a bunch of weird ways, and it infects different parts of the body politic of the human family. Black people are certainly not, or people of African descent are certainly not free of some of that illness, because you can't have something like that be sustained for so many years in this country and it not affect all the parties involved. I think African Americans, the dilemmas are different, I think, in a sense. I think when you talk in terms of cowardice, I think some African Americans are uncomfortable with having these discussions. It's difficult to talk about painful things like that. It's difficult to look at your family's past, look at your family's slave history, embrace it, acknowledge it, and wrestle with what that means for you today. White people, I think they deal with issues of guilt, issues of accountability. Where does the accountability lie? But I think these are all discussions that we have to confront with courage. We've got to. Because otherwise, if we just pretend it doesn't exist, the sickness persists. Nobody ever gets healed. And we find ourselves not only in very similar circumstances to psychologically and emotionally and spiritually to where we've been historically, but even sicker because we've allowed the disease to take deeper root and spread even further. So
that word courage, mm-hmm. and for you as an artist, I'm mm-hmm. curious, what was that moment of courage or the biggest moment of courage for you mm-hmm. as an artist? Just whether acting, whether visual art,
yeah.
just personally, what was that moment for you?
I think it's trying. I think it's making the choice to try. I think to rise and get up and do it again day in and day out, because being an artist is not easy. I mean, as anybody knows, whether you're an actor or a visual artist, a musician, what have you, it can be difficult sometimes, and it's a struggle. So I think the very act of getting up and facing the studio, facing the stage, facing the camera is an act of courage. And for me, every moment that I do that, I feel like I'm behaving in a courageous way. And there's a certain sense of pride that I suppose it goes along with that. Maybe a little bit of delusion, too. I don't know. But, yeah, so, yeah.
Masoud Alufani, mm-hmm. let all of our listeners know how they can find out more mm-hmm. about you and your work.
Sure. You can contact me online. My email address is olufani@yahoo.com. I have a website at www.wixolufani/Mao Sculptor. That's MAO Sculptor.com. So I guess those are the easiest ways to find out what I'm doing. Yeah.
Masoud, thank you for your time.
Hey, brother. Thank you, man.